Welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything
except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor, and today I'm joining the conversation from the studios of Hawaii Public Radio in beautiful Honolulu.
And I'm John Perry in the home offices of KALW San Francisco Information Radio for San Francisco. On Philosophy Talk, we like to think of ourselves, however, as down at Stanford's beautiful campus at Philosophy Corner, although maybe this week Ken's just as happy to be in Hawaii.
Well, yeah, we have a... But, you know, we like to think of ourselves as sitting in a circle. It's just a wide circle today, stretching halfway out into the Pacific Ocean. So what are you going to talk about today, John?
Today, Ken, we're going to talk about who owns ideas. We're going to talk about patents, but more particularly copyrights, because you and I write books. We're happy that when we write books, we get royalties. Our publishers can keep other people from publishing the stuff, should they want to, at least for a while. But the whole thing, to me, is confusing. I mean, how can you own ideas?
What's the big problem? I don't see why is it a big problem?
Well, because ideas, to own something is to have the right to hold on to it and not let others use it. But what's the point of an idea? You can't hold on to it. It's intangible. And the whole point of having an idea is to communicate with others, and you can get credit for it. But how can you own it?
Well, you're right. You don't keep it locked in your head. But, you know, it seems to me, actually, if you think about it, ideas are the paradigm of the kind of thing that you own. I mean, take Locke's theory. John Locke, a great 17th century philosopher, had this theory of property. He says, look, everything starts out not owned. It's held in common. We can all use it freely. How did some things get to be owned, not part of the commons? Well, somebody adds his or her labor to it. They work on it. And by working on it, they make it theirs. So if I pick the apple off the tree, I mean, you could have picked it, but you didn't. I picked the apple off the tree. It's mine. Well, that's kind of crazy. I mean, why, you know, that's a crazy theory. But it works for ideas because an idea is my creation. It's in my head. I created it. I thought it up. So why shouldn't I own it?
Well, Ken, I'm glad you pointed out it's a crazy theory. It's a very intuitive theory, but it doesn't really work for anything. And so the fact that it works well for ideas doesn't mean much. I mean, suppose I take a can of frozen orange juice and pour it in Lake Erie, creating a very weak lake of orange juice or a lake of very weak orange juice. Do I own Lake Erie now? I mean, I think I've screwed up one of Nozick's examples. But the point is, the labor theory of property isn't very good, so the fact that it makes owning ideas sensible doesn't cut for much as far as
I'm concerned. You got a better theory of property? Give me another theory. I'll see if I can make that one work.
Let's go back to your idea of the commons, or Locke's idea of the commons. We still have commons. We have parks. We have Boston's commons. We have things that everybody is entitled to use without asking permission. But if you just have commons, the story goes, look, I mean, we have a common pasture. I run one more sheep on the common pasture. It doesn't make that much difference, and it helps me. But so we all have incentive to run as many sheep as we can on the pasture, but none of us really has an incentive to take our sheep off and let the pasture reinvigorate. So private property is a way of making better use of what might get worn out and overused if it was held in common. None of that applies to ideas. The whole point of an idea is the more people use an idea, the more important it is.
Okay, John, you have a point. I don't know. I still think there's some incentive to private ownership because, you know, I want to exploit my creativity. So there's got to be some incentive for the creator to hold on to the idea exclusively.
Okay, I'll give you that there's incentive. But, you know, our system incentive can easily go awry. Our roving philosophical reporter, Amy Standen, is going to tell us how wacko it's become in the wacko capital of the world, Hollywood.
If there's one place where ideas have always been a hot commodity, it's Hollywood.
People have scripts or ideas or treatments or something that they would like to have translated into a production, either a feature film or television.
Bob Gordon is an attorney in Marin County, California. He's worked in entertainment law for decades.
They would submit these ideas. Normally it would be in a written form to the studio. But two or three years later, there may be some film or television program that was produced, and the person who sent in the idea would consider that his idea was stolen, and he'd get a lawyer and file a lawsuit.
Those cases are a lot less frequent now, mainly because major studios no longer accept unsolicited manuscripts.
If they come in the secretaries or whoever receives this stuff is instructed to send it back unopened. And it's a question of potential liability every time they get something if they don't have some procedure to eliminate the risk.
It's not as easy to avoid lawsuits over the ownership of music. Even small musical phrases can be owned and defended in court.
There is some kind of mythology that you have to use a certain amount, like 10 or 12 notes or something. But I don't really think that's true. I think if you've got four or five notes in a row that are so strong and so recognizable, that's sufficient for liability. And I think there was a case on Fly Me to the Moon using those same notes that ended up in liability, or at least a settlement.
In 1971, ex-Beatle George Harrison released this song, My Sweet Lord. Before the song had even finished its run on the charts, Harrison was sued by the copyright holder of this song, He's So Fine, by the Chiffons. Harrison lost the case on the grounds that he'd, quote, subconsciously plagiarized the Chiffons song. But it took the courts more than a decade to work out exactly how much Harrison owed the Chiffons and their publisher for ripping off the melody. This case, by comparison, was a lot less complicated.
In a recording session, one of the musicians just yelled out the word tequila, which found its way into the recording.
Tequila.
And made a claim, you know, that he was a co-copyright owner because he contributed to the piece, and he got a pretty good settlement for that.
On the other hand, some ideas are so generic that no one can own them.
There was a claim one time that never got into litigation, and it was kind of silly, but somebody actually made a serious claim in writing to a television producer that they ought to do a two-hour special with Jerry Lewis. And then later on, there was a two-hour special with Jerry Lewis, and the guy claimed that he was entitled to compensation for giving the studio that idea. And it never went anywhere, but that's the bottom line of a totally undeveloped idea that was submitted to a studio that I'm sure no lawyer would ever accept that case.
Well, what about a three-hour special? Or a three-hour special with Jerry Lewis and Dean Martin and a chimpanzee? At what point does a generic idea turn into an ownable one? This is Amy Standen for Philosophy Talk.
Fly me to the moon, let me play among the stars.
I'm John Perry. My partner Ken Taylor is speaking with us from Hawaii.
And today we're asking the question, who owns ideas and with what right do they do so?
Joining us to help discuss this is Larry Lessig, professor of law at Stanford University. He got to law in Stanford by way of Cambridge and philosophy, where he was an undergraduate philosophy major studying with Elizabeth Anscombe, among others, for the philosophers in the audience who recognize that name. Larry's most recent book is Free Culture, How Big Media Uses Technology and the Law to Lock Down Culture and Control Creativity. It's available, published by Penguin Press. I think you can also download it from the internet. Larry, it's a pleasure having you with us.
It's fun to be here.
Let me start with this question. It's obvious from the title of your book and from reading this book and your last two, earlier two books, that you have grave reservations about copyright law, and indeed you led a fight all the way to the Supreme Court about extending it. But why, you're not an opponent of copyrights. You believe in limited copyrights. Why have copyrights at all? Why have ownership of ideas? What's the justification?
You're absolutely right. I am fundamentally a believer in copyright. But let's start with some basic premises, which here in Philosophy Talk, I guess you guys like to do. Nobody owns ideas. Ideas are not the subject of property. And in fact, this was one of the founding insights at the time that we set up our Constitution, that ideas would not be subject to property. The famous quote of Thomas Jefferson illustrates this, if I can for a second. Let me share that with you. Jefferson said, and I'm allowed to because it's in the public domain.
Absolutely.
He said, great. If nature That's has good. Made any one thing less susceptible than all others of exclusive property, it is the action of the thinking power called an idea, which an individual may exclusively possess as long as he keeps it to himself. But the moment it is divulged, It forces itself into the possession of everyone, and the receiver cannot dispossess himself of it. Now, he's going to explain why we're going to treat it differently. This is the next passage. Its peculiar character, too, is that no one possesses the less because every other possesses the whole of it. He who receives an idea from me receives instruction himself without lessening mine, as he who lights his taper at mine receives light without darkening me. That ideas should freely spread from one to another over the globe for the moral and mutual instruction of man and the improvement of his condition seems to have been peculiarly and benevolently designed by nature when she made them like fire expansible over all space without lessening their density at any point, and like the air in which we breathe, move, and have our physical being, incapable of confinement or exclusive appropriation. Inventions then cannot in nature be a subject of property. So ideas...
Wow, it's amazing we have any patents.
That's really great.
It's beautiful.
Yeah, wait a minute, Larry, stop for a second. That all sounds great to me as an academic, you know, because one of the things I want to do, I want to share my ideas with people and all that. I want them to build on my ideas. I want them to react to them, you know, disproves. That all sounds great, but where does patents and copyrights, which are about profit, where does all that come from anyway then?
Yeah, so I'm not against profit, and neither was Jefferson. So the first point I want to make sure we're clear about is that it's not ideas that we're protecting through this thing that we've come to call intellectual property. In the context of copyright, we're protecting expression, not ideas. And you protect expression, I think, for very important reasons, because unless you protected expression in some limited way, many authors would not have a sufficient incentive to produce creative new work. So I think it's grounded fundamentally in the idea of incentives to produce. And nothing Locke said contradicts that idea, because what Locke said against the commons was that where you had to, by necessity, a certain form of resource had to be exclusively possessed, then you had to set it up as an exclusive property right. But where it's not by necessity, as Sianna Schifrin has nicely pointed out, nothing in Locke suggests that it has to be subject to exclusive property. So the grounding justification for copyright and patent is the protection granted by the state, a monopoly granted by the state, in order to create incentives to produce something new. Because our Constitution says Congress has the power, in the context of copyright, to promote the progress of science by securing for limited times to authors exclusive right to their writing. So the purpose is clear. It's about promoting progress. And the means are a monopoly for a limited time, and that's all Congress can do.
Let me make a distinction here that maybe other people have been confused about, because I know I have. Credit for ideas is something we feel pretty strongly about in the academic profession. And that goes with the idea. Whoever discovers it or first comes, they get credit for it. But ownership of intellectual property is really something quite different, isn't it? I mean, for example, plagiarism and copyright don't have much to do with each other.
Absolutely. I mean, plagiarism is the only offense that I believe we ought to have the death penalty for. Right? So I'm totally against
people. I can tell you're an academic.
Yeah, that's right. So, but plagiarism has nothing to do with copyright. It's about deception, fraud. That's what plagiarism is. And attribution.
Why don't we take Larry and John, why don't we take that up a little bit more after a short break? You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We're talking about the ownership of ideas, or the expression of ideas, with Professor Larry Lessing of Stanford Law School. We'd like you to join our discussion as well.
We promise to give you full credit for anything you have to say. Give us a call at 415-841-4134. Or ask an email question from the comments link at philosophytalk.org. Philosophy Talk will be right back. That was the Champs and Tequila. If you couldn't figure that out, I don't know what to say. This is Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Our topic, Who Owns Ideas? Our guest is Professor Larry Lessig of Stanford Law School. Share your thoughts with us. The number to call is 415-841-4134.
We'd be particularly interested in people's reaction to the Internet and the topics we're discussing. Has the Internet changed anything? Everything? About the ownership of intellectual property, ideas, patents, and so forth. So let us know what you think. The number again is 415-841-4134. You can also email us directly at comments@philosophytalk.org. Ken, you have a question for Larry.
So Larry, you were going back, you were distinguishing, we were talking about the difference between credit and copyright, and you said that the Constitution entitles Congress to, for the advancement, so how did you put it, for the purposes of the advancement of science, assign limited rights, for a limited period, these different rights. Why did the founders build in this limit, this idea that these things should be limited? Your other property rights aren't limited.
Exactly.
I mean, the government,
right,
if it takes your land, has to compensate you for it. It doesn't say you get to keep this land until, I don't know, year 2006, and then, I mean, why did they do that?
Right, because they understood exactly the point Jefferson was making in that letter many years after the Constitution was drafted. They understood that property, as in tangible property, requires very strict protection. There are always limits, but of course there's still strict protection. If the state comes along and takes that property away, then you've got to compensate the person for taking the property away. But in the context of creative expression, copyrighted works, there is no need to protect against somebody else possessing my work, except to the extent that you've got to create an incentive for somebody to produce the work. So the objectives are different. If you eat my apple, I can't have my apple. Therefore, the state's got to assure me exclusive protection. But with respect to a poem, if you have a poem, I can consume that poem at the same time. You're not any worse off than I am. The only thing the state's worried about is to make sure that we have enough incentives for people to produce poems. And what the framers were fundamentally terrified about is producing exactly what Congress has produced today, a world where a small number of publishers now include, of course, media and television and networks and radio, but a small number of these powerful corporations exercising power through the political process to continue to expand the monopoly protections granted them by the state. So they were trying to avoid exactly what we've produced, and I'm sorry that their very well-crafted design has been laid waste by Congress's avarice for doing whatever lobbyists pay them to do.
So I know that you think that the Internet, going back to John's question a second ago, the Internet threatens these media conglomerates in a major way, and that they're doing everything they can to extinguish this threat. How does the Internet threaten this?
Well, the Internet has the potential to create a wide array of competition for these relatively concentrated producers of music and film and text, because it's a platform where anybody is invited to produce and share work, and that increases competition. The Internet has also changed the way doctrines like copyright actually function, right? Before the Internet, you sit down and read a book. That is an unregulated act under the copyright law. Why? Because when you read a book, you don't produce a copy. You're just reading, right? And copyright law is concerned with, at least in one part, producing copies. But when you do the very same thing on the Internet, when you read a text on the Internet or in any digital network or on a computer, you are technically producing a copy. So technically, copyright law gets invoked over the very same activities which off the Internet are totally unregulated by the law of copyright. So that's one of the reasons why there's been such a problem created by the Internet and copyright, because the technology is expanding the reach of the law in the way that Congress never imagined originally.
Let me back up a minute and see if I understand and review the bidding here a little. So you're saying that that the Constitution framers really didn't see copyright as sort of a fundamental, God-given, inalienable right. They saw it as something that would promote something good for society, the creation of artistic and intellectual works. It was a pragmatic, one might say a utilitarian motivation. And what they had in mind there was a certain structure of production, writers and publishers with publishing on paper, with presses and so forth. Now that we live in a much different world where, you know, you can type without a typewriter, and they didn't even have typewriters. You can publish without paper. How does the law take an idea like that in the Constitution and adapt it to a new situation? How do lawyers think of what they're doing, and how do you as a philosophically trained lawyer think of what you're doing?
Well, let me quibble a bit with the question. The question really should be, how should the law deal with it? How you say, how do lawyers think about it? I'm not sure there's much evidence lawyers are thinking about it.
I'm glad you said that. All right.
I mean, because the problem is our framers understood that the protection for intellectual property, copyrights and patents, needed to be balanced all the time in light of new technologies. And the history of copyright law has been a very good history of balancing the protections against new technology. So when a new technology comes along that changes the way works get distributed, the law gets updated to reflect that. But for some reason, I'm not yet sure I can fully explain beyond the cynical story about politicians being bought off by lobbyists. The internet has stopped that traditional practice of restriking a balance between technology and the protections of copyright. The internet has come along, and we've gone into extremist mode, as if unless you believe in absolute protection for copyright, far beyond anything the framers ever imagined, you're essentially a communist. We have a kind of IP McCarthyism reigning in Washington right now
about
this topic.
Is that because of the potential of the internet to undermine and undo the monopoly power of these conglomerates? If left unchecked, I mean, in a world in which they didn't have these extreme protections, would they just whittle away to competition? I mean, that's a factual question, but I wonder what you think about that.
Yeah, we can do facts on Philosophy Talk.
That's all right.
All right. Okay. Yeah. Fine. Yeah, absolutely. I think that at least certain businesses are threatened by what the internet offers, but it doesn't follow that, you know, for example, creative work in the context of music is threatened. I mean, let's focus on music. It's a great example. You know, publishers in the context of music are a very concentrated small number of companies. Maybe five companies control over 85% of the distribution of music in the world. They make a lot of money controlling, in this cartel-like way, the distribution of music. And they exercise intellectual property rights, copyright, to say that every time you make a copy of my music, you should be compensated. But we could have a different system where people like Terry Fisher at Harvard have mapped a way that artists could be paid based on how much their work was being consumed, not trying to control the copies of it, but just trying to facilitate wide distribution and a kind of Nielsen technology for figuring out who's consuming what, and then we pay people on the basis of that. That would create lots more incentive for people to become musicians. It would lower the cost to consumers. It would also happen to hurt these relatively small cartel of music publishers who exist right now. So they fight proposals like this, and they convince Congress that they have to support their monopoly position when there's an alternative here that could actually benefit consumers and music much more generally.
You're listening to Philosophy Talk on KALW. Our topic today is who owns ideas, copyright, patents, the internet, things like that. I'm John Perry, and with me from Hawaii is Ken Taylor, and our guest is Larry Lessig of Stanford's Law School. Larry, we can talk about facts on Philosophy Talk as long as we don't overdo it. And I read your colloquy with the Supreme Court. Professor Lessig took this case that the term limit extension, the Sonny Bono term limit or copyright limit term extension, was unconstitutional to the Supreme Court. The justices, I guess, you didn't win. Not to put too fine a point on it.
I lost.
Were some more sympathetic than others? Did they get it at all? I didn't get the sense in reading it that very many of them did.
Oh, I didn't either.
Yeah, two justices clearly got it, Justice Breyer and Justice Stevens. But the rest of them didn't.
Right. Breyer, like you, was a philosophy major. He was at Stanford, not Cambridge.
And he was an economist, too. Uh-huh. So he understood both the philosophy and the economics.
Okay, we've got some callers. Let's hear from Greg in San Rafael. Hi, Greg.
Hi.
What's your question?
Well, I've got a situation here that I'd like to get the input of the professionals on. So I go to school at Cornell in New York, but I live in the Bay Area. And
that's a long commute.
Yeah, I've been to the Berkeley-Stanford big football game, and anybody who's been there, at least, I haven't been there in a couple years, so maybe it's changed, but I remember that all of the Berkeley students wore these blue shirts, and it said in gold, an expletive, and then Stanford, spelled S-T-A-N-F-U-R-D. That's not the real spelling of Stanford.
Thank you.
Make it look a little stupid. But, And so I saw this. I was like, this is great. I could bring this back to Cornell because here back at Cornell, there's a big hockey game against Harvard. And so I want to do the same thing with a red shirt with white Cornell colors saying expletive Harvard spelled H-A-V-A-H-D, kind of like the Harvard accent.
Harvard, yeah.
And so I printed out 100 of these shirts. I just called up a internet T-shirt company, and they sent them out, no problem, no copyright warning infringements or anything. And I started distributing these shirts, selling them for $10 a pop. And I instantly got a bunch of emails, not from any administration, but from students who had heard about this. And they said, warning, like, you shouldn't do this. We've tried doing similar things with other shirts.
Oh, dear. The litigious East versus the laid-back West.
Exactly. And they said, don't do this. Like, both Harvard and Cornell will see you into the ground. And, like, one guy gave an example of a shirt. He made a shirt that said, give me an A, give me another A, welcome to Harvard, as in the great inflation. And he said that he got emails from Cornell and Harvard saying, we will sue you out of your life.
Okay, let's ask our panelists here, one professional, one lawyer, what about this?
Yeah.
What's the law, and what's the morality of these T-shirts?
Well, you know, first of all, it's a story of overreaching, I think, in the context of the law here. This is a different kind of intellectual property law. It's trademark law that we're mm-hmm. discussing now. And trademark law has always been understood to be different from the kind of law protecting copyrights and patents. The purpose of trademark law is to make sure that consumers are not confused about who the maker is of a certain product. So if you drive up to a McDonald's on a highway and it turns out not really to be Ray Kroc's McDonald's, but some Joe Schmo that mm-hmm. set up something called McDonald's, you know, you might think, I want low-quality hamburgers here, and it turns out to be high-quality hamburgers, and that would be a trademark problem because you don't really know who the original owner is. So that's why we have trademark. Now, in the context of trademark, there are very strong exceptions for free speech purposes. So I'm allowed to use I'm involved in a case right now involving Fox News. So I'm allowed to use Fox News and use their trademark in order to criticize them, if that's the way I need to criticize them, or to make fun of them. And so I would find it very surprising if Harvard would actually sue some entrepreneur like you because he used a misleadingly similar name like Harvard as a way of making fun of Harvard.
Is that reassuring, Greg?
I'm giving no legal advice.
Yeah. Well, but parody is an important aspect of freedom of speech. And, you know, if you can't parody Coca-Cola and George Bush and Harvard and Stanford, it's not a very free and open environment. You got any comments on this, Ken?
Yeah, I'd like. I mean, you know, academics. I wonder if this would work in the rest of the world, Larry. I just wonder. Academics appropriate others' ideas all the time. I mean, they appropriate them with attribution. They say they quote, they build upon, they even do things like refute or disprove. But they're constantly tangling with one another's ideas. Constantly, you know, I mean, a great philosopher starts a program of research. One of his graduate students pushes it forward. Some other student comes along and changes its direction. That happens all the time. Do you think that sort of thing could work? I mean, why not? Why can't the marketplace of ideas in general be like that? Is there any reason why it couldn't be?
Well, what's great about the question is that I think 50 years ago it would have sounded like a bizarre question. Yet today it sounds like a totally sensible question. 50 years ago it would have sounded bizarre because I think the system of copyright in particular was a much more restrained system that made it obvious that what culture was generally was the ability of people to mix other people's work and to extend it in a certain way. Culture is remix, but in the way that academics is remix. I mean, you only live as an academic, and let's be clear, as a lawyer, by taking other people's works, quoting them, building upon them, extending them, refuting them, doing all the things that we expect free society to be able to do. But currently, the way copyright has developed, there is this presumption that if you're going to use other people's works, you got to go out there Oliver Twist-like and beg for permission first. So, you know, imagine writing a critical review of somebody's book and having to go and ask permission before you can use quotes in the critical review.
Right.
And the author would say, well, is it a favorable review or a critical review?
Right.
And if it's a critical review, no, I'm not going to give you permission.
Well, right, you have to pay them an awful lot.
That's right.
Well, you talk in your book about people that want to make a film and they have to go get permission from the guy who did the poster that appears on the wall in the background.
The best example of this is Andy Warhol, right, the state. So Andy Warhol, of course, made his money by taking other people's works and reappropriating them, the Campbell soup can. So when they made Life of Brian, there was a shot at a bus stop where there was a poster, an Andy Warhol poster in the background. So they Life of Brian, Monty Python, realized they had to get permission for that. So they went to the Warhol estate and they said, okay, how much to have this poster barely visible in our scene? And the Warhol estate is on $150,000. Now talk about chutzpah, right?
Yeah, I mean, yeah.
Andy Warhol?
That was probably a Campbell soup can.
That's right.
I'm sitting here trying to think, now why, if I'm just the average Joe out there, why should I care? And I think we've stumbled on why one should care about this. Because this is really about the creation of our common culture in this capitalist setting that we live in. How is it going to go? Is it going to be free and freewheeling, or is it going to be tightly controlled by a few narrow,
Ken, let's see if that's also what's on the mind of another East Bay caller, Catherine in Oakland. Catherine, are you on the line?
I'm here.
Hi, Catherine.
Hi.
What's your question?
Hi. I'm going to start calling you the Blather Brothers. Well, anyway.
The Blather Brothers. Yeah.
Well, years ago, like around 1983, I was working at a really tiny non-commercial radio station, and I wrote up a spot for our Halloween party to publicize it, and in which two people are deciding what to wear for Halloween, and one says, well, we'll wrap you all up in aluminum foil and you can go as a leftover. Well, about 10 years later, I'm sitting on a couch with two kids watching Casper the Friendly Ghost, the movie with Christina Ricci, and they're deciding what to wear for Halloween. And he says, oh, we'll wrap you all up in aluminum foil and you can go as a leftover. So I had a kind of a combination of satisfaction and outrage, and I wonder, where are my royalties?
Well, did you actually pursue this?
What?
Did you actually pursue this, Catherine?
Oh, no, I didn't. I'm just using it as an example. I mean, when do ideas float around? It was just a spot on a non-commercial radio station.
It's a great example because...
It's flattering, but kind of weird.
It's a great example.
Thanks for the call, Catherine.
What it points out is a very fundamental fact about copyright law that I think people overlook sometimes. In order to violate somebody's copyright, you have to copy their work, right? So in order to establish that the person who reused it in the Casper movie had violated any right that you might have... you'd have to establish that they copied the work. Now, it is a creative use, a kind of clever use, but it probably isn't you're probably not the only person in the history of the world who'd thought about that particular phrasing. And so it would probably be pretty hard to establish that somebody had copied the work from you. And if they hadn't copied the work from you, there is no violation of any right at all.
You know, I'm going around trying to get the idea out that a certain political candidate should be called the bait and switch president. I won't tell you which one. And I'd be pleased as punch if I suddenly saw this appearing all over the world. I wouldn't ask for any money or even credit. But I guess, that's a non-paradigm case. We've got an email here that's kind of interesting from Mark. Mark asks, do the participants of a real-life event have some sort of ownership over their part in that event? Are they owed some sort of remuneration by a third party who creates a work based on their experience in that event? We're going to return to that question after we take a break. This is Philosophy Talk. I'm John Perry. You can call us at 841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And we'll be right back. Leslie Gore and You Don't Own Me. I'm John Perry. This is Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. Today we're talking about the ownership of ideas. Our guest is the author Larry Lessig of Stanford Law School. You can join our discussion by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. John, I think just before the break you had a question,
We had an interesting email question about what ownership do we have about over real-life events that other people may photograph or write into a book or something like that. Any at all?
Hard question to answer in general. If it's a real-life event is a dance or a choreographed event, then the person who's dancing or has a choreographed event might have a copyright in those particular aspects of the creative work. But in general, if you're in public and doing something and I write about it or I tell that story, It's very hard to establish legal restrictions on my ability to build on that. But
what if you're a famous public figure who makes a living off your image? Can people just take pictures of you? And
yeah, well, this is a particularly important question in the context of California, because our governor, of course, is a former movie star, maybe still a movie star. And he has been extraordinarily aggressive in insisting on his right of publicity. That's the right that protects famous people against commercial appropriation of their images. So somebody was making a bobbing head doll of the governor next to a George Bush bobbing head doll. And his lawyers went after that person and saying that it violated his right to publicity, which, you know, from the perspective of the law, I think is an outrageous claim. If you're going to be the governor of a state, you in some sense have to give people the right to parody you. And that's exactly what they were doing with the bobbing head doll.
Let me ask you a question of a bit more positive nature. That is, you've thought long and hard about these things. You've argued to the Supreme Court. You've written three books on various aspects of it. But can you give us, in a nutshell, what your positive view of copyright and patents ought to be? If you were going to give a law to Congress to update their thinking on this that achieves the kind of balance you've been talking about, how would it read? What would it look like, and why?
Well, not the full text of it.
Well, you know, it's hard for me to be positive. My brand is usually pessimism here. But the positive law looks something like this. We only protect as much as is necessary to serve the legitimate commercial ends of what copyright's to protect. But we leave free lots of use that doesn't infringe on the legitimate commercial interest. Because as Ken was saying a bit ago, what's really at stake here is the ability of people using the technologies of the network and digital tools to be able to creatively participate in the creation and sharing of our culture. And the existing rules, as we have them right now, basically require that before people engage in that creative act, if they want to comply with the law, they've got to go beg permission from every copyright owner in the world just to remix our culture. That is a radical shift from where we were even just 30 years ago. And it just happens to happen at the time when there's just a few concentrated media giants who essentially own the vast majority of our culture. So we've gone, I think, from a free culture. You know, I think if we had the law that Richard Nixon gave us before 1976, I would be happy with the extent of copyright protection.
Nostalgia for the Nixon era. I never thought I'd hear that.
Well,
Kathy, we have a caller on the line. Kathy in Oakland. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Kathy.
Hi. I wanted to ask, as someone who is thinking about putting ideas or products out there, is there some way I can check and see if my idea is original? I mean, I'm always afraid I've, you know, heard something or gotten it somewhere else. And I'll take my answer off the air. Thank you.
Thanks, Kathy.
So if you want to write about it, you don't have to worry about whether it's original in the sense that if you write about it without copying somebody else's work, then you're producing an original work. If you're interested in patenting the idea, patenting an invention, then, of course, you can pay lawyers thousands of dollars and they can go investigate whether anybody has patented the invention before. We haven't begun to talk about the failings of the patent system, which have become astronomical, especially for Silicon Valley, as software and business method patents have made it so that engineers have to have lawyers sitting next to them as they do their creativity. But the simplest way to know that in the context of patents is to hire an investigator to see whether, in fact, somebody's patented your idea before.
We have some more comments from email. Lawrence gives us some quotes. Woody Guthrie is approached at a party by a friend and says, beware of Theodore Bickel, he'll steal from you. Woody responds, yeah, he steals from me, but I steal from everybody. In a similar vein, a quote from Salvador Dali, all art that isn't plagiarism is outright theft. Do our conceptions of copyright and authorship kind of overemphasize the originality and the contribution that the kind of the final, what is the final involved person makes to a work of art or a piece of philosophy?
Absolutely. And I think it's relatively modern that this has happened. You know, even if you go back to Walt Disney, one of my heroes, who created an extraordinary empire, the Disney Corporation. Think of all of the works that Disney built his empire on, you know, works building on the Brothers Grimm, works building on stories that were part of our culture, works building on Victor Hugo, Hunchback of Notre Dame. all of the major works of Walt Disney were, in a sense, works that built on works that came before. And what he did, of course, was original. He remixed them in a way that actually expressed a kind of creativity. But he couldn't have produced the work that he produced without works that he added to from the past. And I think Disney is a nice example of the ideal that we ought to be aspiring to. Some people want better quality, maybe. I don't have much taste, so I'm happy with Disney. But the idea of creativity that Disney exemplified, I think, is what we ought to aspire to, where you are free to build and transform and remix culture that went before. You're not free to copy somebody's work directly if it's copyrighted or take and try to profit off of their work, but you are free to remix it in a way that our culture no longer permits. Because, Disney now, the Disney Corporation now, if you tried to remix what Walt Disney did in 1930, would answer your efforts at creativity with a bunch of lawyers.
Larry and John, I want to, I don't think we've heard it. I'm not quite sure what to say on behalf of the contrary view, but I'm going to try to be a curmudgeon for a second. Okay, these corporations are entities, they're just, and they invest, and they're entitled to return. And I mean, why, they're not evil guys necessarily. They make all this stuff available to us. I mean, it seems to me that your complaint might just be, well, these corporations have taken hold of copyright and used it for their own benefit and good, but we also benefit from that. And I mean, why pound on them so much? They're just trying to make a profit.
What would
our
culture be like without Walt Disney?
Yeah, I'm not criticizing Walt Disney, criticizing the Disney Corporation. And I'm not criticizing corporations in general. I'm criticizing particular overreaching in the context of copyright. I mean, let's go back to the case that I lost in the Supreme Court. This was the Sonny Bono Copyright Term Extension Act. It extended the term of existing copyrights for 20 years. It was the 11th time in the last 40 years that Congress has extended the term of existing copyrights. Now, think about the justification for copyright. It is to create an incentive to produce something new. The one thing we know about the logic of incentives is that they are prospective. No matter what we do today, George Gershwin is not going to produce anything more. So there is no logic related to incentives for increasing the term of existing copyrights. Yes, that's what Congress is now doing. So you're right. I'm happy that if somebody creates something new and original for them to get their reward. I'm happy if I get a reward from my book. But I see no justification at all for a corporation going in and lobbying Congress so that an existing work that was produced by an author 50, 70, now 95 years ago continues to extend the protection for another 20 years, destroying the public domain, essentially.
So it sounds like, given your analysis, our current position is we've got in the internet an absolutely unprecedented opportunity for having a commons, intellectual commons that of just terrific potential, and we've got a Congress, about 8/9 of which, and a Supreme Court about which 5/7 of, are totally clueless about basic philosophical conceptions for which the whole thing exists.
Philosophical and historical, I testified at Congress about a fair use bill, and I was astonished by the level of, what's the polite way of saying ignorance? I forget that word. But
stupidity.
That's not quite as polite as
there
I
aren't
want
any
to be.
Polite ways.
Yeah,
just
but the
it.
Point is they don't have any clue about this basic point about how we limit the protection in the context of copyright in order to create incentives for other people to produce.
Maybe that's what we get for letting politicians write books.
No, that's what you get when you let big corporations do the lobbying and have access to the bill writing. I mean, who gets access to them to lobby for how copyright should be treated except the big conglomerate?
That's the biggest problem. And people who believe that that's a problem need to begin to support organizations that are trying to do something different. So I'm on the board of EFF, the Electronic Frontier Foundation, and Public Knowledge. Those are two organizations that you can find on the web that are trying to do something different. And I actually run a private foundation, Creative Commons, which is not trying to change the law, but is trying to make it easy for creators to mark their content with the freedoms they intend their content to carry so that others can go and build upon that content without hiring a lawyer first. The problem now is that the system requires lawyers infused through all acts of creativity, and that's insane, and that's coming from someone who produces lawyers for a living. So it's got to be a certain incentive.
John, it seems to me that Larry, I think you do a good job. Your books, I love your books. I think one of the things that we have to do is make the people care about this.
That's
make
right.
the people see that their culture, the production of their culture, is being taken away from them and taken over by these large corporations.
That's right.
Our guest today has been Larry Lessig of Stanford Law School, and it's been extremely interesting discussion. And you can continue your interaction with his ideas by getting a copy of his most recent book, Free Culture: How Big Media Uses Technology and the Law to Lock Down Culture and Control Creativity. Larry, it's been a pleasure having you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Thanks, Larry. So, John, what did you learn today?
Well,
are you wiser?
Between the reading I did in preparation for this and today, I think I've learned a lot. For one thing, I've learned that what I think most academics care about is credit, not copyright. I know that universities give endless seminars on copyright, and many of us never quite get it because deep down we don't care. If we were writing books that were really popular, mystery novels or popular philosophy books, then we care a little. I learned that it's not very clear what the basis for copyright is. And the most reasonable philosophical basis seems to suggest that it's really not a very basic right. It's not even as basic as property rights, certainly not as basic as the right to life, liberty, and happiness. Or the pursuit of happiness, and that given the most plausible reconstruction of why we have copyright, it should probably be, as Lessig suggests, limited and constantly readjusted to keep the balance for which it was intended in view.
Yeah, I tend to agree. I actually started out, before I plunged into Lessig's books and other things, I started out thinking, well, yeah, I created, I should own it. I own it forever. My estate should be able to own it. I was gung-ho about this. I bought the kind of capitalist incentive line, but he actually convinced me otherwise, and his books are a great read. I really recommend them to people.
Well, you know, I've written a couple little dialogues that people use in introductory classes, and I think they've got some originality, but they definitely benefit from the whole tradition of philosophy, and I enjoy getting the royalties on them. But
The minor royalties,
but it's not the end of the world. Our last word on the subject comes from Ian Scholes, the 62nd philosopher.
Ian Scholes. In 1511, the artist Albrecht Dürer warned forgers, "Think not rashly to lay your thievish hands upon my works. Beware, know you not that I have a grant from the most glorious emperor, Maximilian?" When the printing press came along, authors and artists no longer needed emperors to protect them from forgers, but who would protect them from publishers? The first copyright law was the Statute of Anne, passed in England in 1710, giving authors book rights for 14 years after publication. But when a small bookseller in Scotland began publishing reprints of no longer recent books, he was sued by larger booksellers who claimed that reprints would ruin them, and that contrary to the Statute of Anne, ownership was a natural right, not subject to legislation. The booksellers, of course, were fighting for their self-perceived right to publish overpriced versions of Shakespeare until the sun sets in the British Empire. After 50 years of litigation, the big booksellers lost, and the term public domain came into existence. Around this time, John Locke was exploring the idea of property. Property, he believed, belongs to all of us, but one's person belonged to oneself. When you mix common property with your own hard work, you exercise your right to survive, giving you a special right to the fruit of your labors. But if you exchange those fruits for money, the fruits are no longer yours. That is how the concept of intellectual property came to be. The raw materials of a written work, language, and concepts are held by all, but the author's labor gives it value, and the theft of a work of the imagination deprives its creator of money he might get from it. In 1791, the German philosopher Johann Gottlieb Fichte further laid the foundation for modern copyright. He wrote, quote, "Once published, the ideas in a book belong to all, but the singular form of their expression remains the sole property of the author," unquote. Today, we've come a long way from books. The concept of ownership is a tangled thicket of a web with downloading issues and non-disclosure agreements. In a world where everything from Marlene Dietrich's legs to Vanna White's hand gestures to computer processes to genetic patterns can be copyrighted, patented, and trademarked, Victor Hugo, a great advocate of authors' rights, nonetheless wrote in the 1870s, quote, "Think of a man like Dante, Moliere, Shakespeare. Imagine when he has just finished a great work. Suppose that he gets the idea to throw it into the fire. Nobody can stop him. But as soon as the work is published, the author is not anymore the master," unquote. Pierre Hugo, Victor's great-grandson, recently sued to stop the publication of a new sequel to Les Miserables, calling it a betrayal of the original. The court ruled against him, using Victor Hugo's own words. Well, you know what that means. You can't download Les Mis for free, but if you want to take a whack at rewriting Les Miserables, go ahead. It's legal. I gotta go.
Philosophy Talk is a presentation of Ben Manila Productions and the trustees of Leland Stanford Junior University. Copyright 2004.
Executive producer, Gordon Earle.
Our production team includes Peter Crimmins, Amy Standen, Monica Blakely, Alex Martinez, Jim Swenson, Merle Kessler, Matt Bauer, and Olga Kramer of Whitetail Web Design.
Special thanks go to Nicole Sawaya, Roman Mars, and Alan Farley, our engineer.
Support for Philosophy Talk comes from the Hoover Institution, the Greenwall Foundation, and the Pacific Division of the American Philosophical Association.
And also from the Provost Office at Stanford University, the Dean of Humanities and Sciences, Stanford's Office of Public Affairs, the Stanford Humanities Center, the Friends of Philosophy Talk, that's you, and the members of KALW Information Radio, San Francisco, where our program originates. They make our shoestring possible.
The views expressed on this program do not necessarily represent the opinions of Stanford University or of our funders.
Or anybody else. For that matter, John. For more information, visit philosophytalk.org.
I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. Thank you for listening.
And thank you for thinking.